and welcome to episode 8 of Investigating the Post Office Scandal. I'm Rebecca Thompson, the journalist that published the first investigation into the Post Office Horizon scandal back in 2009 when I worked at Computer Weekly.
And my name is Nick Wallace. I wrote the book, The Great Post Office Scandal. Today, we're speaking to Paul Marshall, the barrister whose work was fundamental in exposing the extent of the post office's wrongdoing at the Court of Appeal in 2021.
Paul has written to the Director of Public Prosecutions asking him to investigate the possibility that several people at the post office were engaged in a conspiracy to pervert the course of justice at times throughout the Horizon scandal, and that was originally due to be the main focus of our conversation this episode.
But yesterday, Eleanor Shake, who is a woman who's campaigned assiduously for the postmaster's cause, received a response to a Freedom of Information request, which fetched up what I think could be the most significant new document to have been unearthed in the post office scandal so far this year.
It's called the Chairman's Review, and it was commissioned by the new chairman of the post office at the time, Tim Parker, in 2015, at the request of the then Postal Affairs Minister, Baroness Neville Rolfe.
I've already written a blog post about it, but I'll be perfectly honest, neither Rebecca or I have had a huge amount of time to dig into it. So we set Paul Marshall the task of running his forensic eye over what this report actually had to say. And we asked him what he thought was some of the most significant elements to it.
It's a long document. It runs to 65 pages. It's dated the 8th of February 2016. It's written by Jonathan Swift, QC, now Mr. Justice Swift, and Christopher Knight. Christopher Knight is still of 11 King's Bench Walk. Jonathan Swift was then senior Treasury Counsel, first Treasury Counsel. It's a very important document. In my estimation, and I think it's fair to say, I know something about the long and sad history of this matter. It's of similar importance to the disclosure in November 2020 of the now perhaps infamous Clark advice. In terms of what it includes, the most important recommendations were that the post office needed to carefully look at firstly, the way in which it had procured, some instances, pleas of guilty to criminal offences of false accounting, in circumstances where sometimes charges were brought in addition to false accounting of theft. This is a very important issue in my view, and one which has received perhaps insufficient attention, but it's well known now that very frequently the post office, as it were, leveraged pleas to false accounting on the basis of threats to charge theft in addition, or charging that to start with and then agreeing to a plea of guilty to the lesser charge. Rightly, in my view, Mr. Swift recommended that the post office should look very carefully at what had happened in various instances.
It was the thing that struck me about that report as the main red flag that Swift had raised, that there was this evidence of slapping a theft charge onto a false accounting charge in order to try and plea bargain down. Now, I know plea bargaining isn't an official part of accepted practice within our criminal justice system, but it seems to go on a lot. Is his concern at the practice in general, or at the fact that in at least one case there didn't seem to be any evidence of theft whatsoever?
Yes, he picks that up, and I was slightly startled by his conclusion about that. He said that the fact that there wasn't, it was acknowledged that there wasn't enough evidence to charge theft wasn't necessarily indicative that a charge of theft couldn't in fact be brought and sustained, which I found a little bit surprising. But I mean, that's getting into the detail of it. But I think his overall view is, and I hope I'm being fair to him, is that the practice of, as it were, leveraging pleas of guilty to false accounting on the basis that in the alternative, a charge of theft with greater penalties would be pursued, reflected very badly on the post office. He says that this reflects extremely badly on the post office as an institution. The second point that arises from this review is that Mr. Swift alights very clearly on the problem with the ability or the capacity of the post office and Fujitsu to remotely access, what's called remotely access, postmaster branch accounts.
This is something the post office had denied was at all possible to Panorama in the August of the previous year. They had said it is not and has never been possible for anyone to access sub-postmaster branch accounts. And yet Jonathan Swift has clearly picked up on the fact that it is possible.
Yeah, he's picked up that it's possible. He's picked up that there are two ways, two possibilities where balancing accounts are capable of being affected, including one where he records that in order to do so, it's necessary to fabricate an electronic signature. But in any event, he's alive to the fact that it is possible and was possible to do, with a consequence, very important consequence, that an explanation given to Parliament to quote what I think is a highly misleading expression, that there was no functionality in Horizon to permit remote access to postmaster branch accounts, was completely untrue. As Mr. Justice Fraser says in his judgment, the question is, was it possible for the post office with Fujitsu to access postmaster's account and manipulate their data without them knowing and therefore without their authorization?
So just take me through this then. Jonathan Swift flags this up in the chairman's report, which we know is not given to the whole post office board. This was in 2016, very shortly before the group litigation started cranking into gear, in which the post office said that remote access was not possible.
Yeah. So there are two possibilities. Either his recommendation was simply ignored by those who received this report, or alternatively it was. He says it needs to be bottomed out and resolved. The only other conclusion, if it wasn't ignored, is that it was bottomed out, the result or the conclusion was unpalatable and simply suppressed or withheld. I think probably that the latter is less likely than the former.
I just wonder, because of course what happened immediately after was the litigation, and we're all now in the privileged position of viewing this in hindsight, just how important this document was to the post office at the time.
Well, it's a fundamental importance. I was about to say that really it's the end point really, and it sets the scene for the post office's approach until 2019. There are three things at the end which he makes reference to, which he says ought to be done by the post office. The first in relation to leveraging guilty pleas to false accounting. The second is wanting to bottom out this whole issue, which the post office persisted in falsely maintaining that there was no access possible to postmaster accounts. And the third, very importantly, was a issue which Second Sight raised originally in their first, I think it's in their first interim report in 2013. They say there's a concern that unattributed funds in post office suspense accounts may in fact be the missing amounts from shortfalls in postmaster branch Horizon accounts. This is of fundamental importance. And Mr. Swift says that ought to be bottomed out, and there ought to be a analysis of those sums, some of which were quite substantial. And it's somebody with technical expertise will tell you that figures in a computerized accounting system don't just disappear. If they're not present somewhere, they will be present somewhere else.
So I mean, there are hard recommendations in this report. And you can sort of they are contextualized and put into palatable language, perhaps, and they do lean towards the post office not having done much wrong, or at least not acted in bad faith. But wouldn't it be incumbent on the chairman, who was the person responsible for commissioning Swift to write the report, to do something really, really radical? I just wonder what positions are being protected here, because the red flags are being raised despite the language of the report and the sort of the overall sheen of soft soaping that it gets. But where is the leadership? I mean, or what is stopping either Paula Venables or Tim Parker from going, oh my God, we really need to call in some help here and sort this out?
But do you not think that the report isn't raising those red flags in the way that it perhaps could have done? Because, you know, it's got that line in there in the paragraph 106 about where it talks about the stain on the character of the business. Then it goes on to say that we don't consider that this issue arises in cases where there has been a conviction following a trial, so it's only where a supposed master has pleaded guilty, which I don't think is right, because isn't that what happened with Seema?
Well, there's not going to be a trial if they plead guilty in advance of the trial, as for example Janet Skinner did. She was prosecuted. She was to be prosecuted for theft and false accounting, and she was advised to plead guilty because of the consequences and likelihood of a custodial sentence if she didn't plead guilty to false accounting, and she got a custodial sentence anyway. Well, yeah, there are clear red flags here, which ought to have been of enormous concern to the post office. In particular, I mean, the most obvious one is the public statement by the post office contradicting the Panorama programme. And the Panorama had Richard Roll, who was of ultimately the decisive witness on this issue, saying it was possible. Panorama said that, the post office said that remote access to postmaster accounts was not possible. Well, this, in terms, Mr. Swift identifies that it was possible. So that ought to have been of great concern. Not only was it a statement made publicly by the post office had said this to Parliament, and it ought to have been of the most enormous concern to the board of the post office. This is a public position being taken by the post office.
It seems to me that the he is raising red flags, but he's also sort of hinting through his language that there's a way out of all this. He's not saying, look, this. But what I'm trying to understand, and I've constantly tried to do this throughout my investigations into the post office, is if you put yourself in the executive's shoes and you're staring down the barrel of God knows how many potential miscarriages of justice, why hide it? Why not just say, look, this is bigger than maybe the government's desire to ensure the post office continues as a going concern. This is a resignation matter for potentially everyone involved if we do not right now blow this open. I don't understand what position they were protecting that was either personal or for some misguided sense of being in the wider public good or under government instruction to keep all this kind of stuff under wraps. It just doesn't make any sense.
It's my conclusion on that point that caused me eventually to decide that I should probably write to the Director of Public Prosecutions about what I consider to be a prima facie case of perverting the course of justice. And I think the explanation that you are, as it were, struggling to identify is one that is buried in Mr. Justice Fraser's Horizon Issues judgment. And it really resolves itself in this, that between 2010 and 2013, the post office had multiple sources of information that were pointing in the direction of Horizon being an arguably flawed system with bugs in it that were capable of producing the kind of problems that postmasters were concerned about and had complained of in their prosecutions. At bottom, its most simple illustration is what's called the receipts and payments mismatch bug, which was identified in 2010, immediately before Seema Misra's trial. That bug had the effect of causing a postmaster's accounts to appear to balance at terminal when on Fujitsu's main servers in Bracknell there would be a discrepancy, and that would not be known to a postmaster. Now, this was discussed, and it was the subject of a memorandum published in 2013 and widely disseminated within the post office. There's a reference to that in Mr. Swift's report, but I'm not sure that he has read it, because if one reads that memorandum, it is absolutely clear that this is the effect, i.e. the effect of there being a discrepancy that occurs on the mainframe but is not apparent to an operator, was recognised as potentially impacting post office prosecutions. The reason it's terribly important is that in Mrs. Misra's case, the prosecution opening and closing speeches to the jury both included statements that if there was a bug in the system, its effects would be apparent to an operator. Now,
it would have been obvious.
That's simply wrong.
But doesn't Tim Parker coming in? But Paul, Tim Parker coming in, gets this report commissioned, receives it, looks at it, and goes, "I am resigning unless we sort this out." And someone at government says, "Oh no, you can't resign. We need you on board to make sure this is done properly."
Again, the simple answer is the acknowledgement of the problems that were recognised and were plainly visible to the post office in 2013 and which caused it to cease prosecuting its postmasters. If those had been publicly acknowledged, either generally or more specifically and importantly to those it had prosecuted, the inescapable conclusion from those concessions would be that the post office could not tell the difference between fraud and the effects of a computer bug. And that is, in effect, the overall conclusion of Mr. Justice Fraser in his Horizon Issues judgment, because what he says is, in terms, obviously individual defendants weren't there were a sample, but he wasn't concerned with individual cases. But his conclusion was that the Horizon system was capable of causing the problems which were the common complaint and experience of postmasters. And if that had been recognised in 2013, it would have effectively torpedoed the post office's commercial business model, because...
But you're Tim Parker, you come into the business, you get this report from Jonathan Swift, you look at what Paula Venables was doing back in 2013, you call her into your office and you say, "You're going to have to resign. You do realise you're going to have to resign." And Venables says, "All right, well, I'll take the whole ship down with me," or whatever, I don't know. Why was nothing done?
Those who had responsibility and were mandated by the government to turn the post office into a profitable enterprise for the purpose, one assumes, for eventually privatising it, the recognition of the true effect of these problems would have effectively sunk the post office commercially. One sees that with the fact of the post office having in 2013 reported its concerns to its insurers. This is a huge matter. It's received virtually no commercial.
Yeah, but that's why I don't understand. Go on, Rebecca.
I was just going to say, do you not think it's possible that Tim Parker didn't see these red flags?
I don't think it's fair to assume that people, particularly people in important positions of prominence, are either don't read documents or are so foolish or incompetent as to not to recognise their implications. I mean, the implications of this document are plain to see. And the obvious questions are, were the three recommendations implemented? If not, why not? And who took the decision? If they were implemented, what happened to the reports of those who undertook the further work? I mean, there's no indication anywhere that any of that work was done.
No, there's not. But we just said that the overall tone of this report is almost quite Yeah, there are definitely red flags, and certainly to us now, but it's relatively, especially around the thing about disclosure, it's relatively, there are some issues, but it's generally okay.
Yeah, I mean,
You just.
you wonder at Tim Parker's antennae, don't you? But he was cute enough not to give it to the whole board because he knew how explosive the document was, presumably. I mean, I can't imagine why else the board should not get to see it.
Or because he didn't see how explosive it was.
Well, I find that I find that very difficult to accept, really. I mean, there's so many things in it that that are either incomplete or unsatisfactory, or raise sort of very concrete and troubling issues. I mean, we've been round it once already, but the statement about remote access. It's called remote access. It's not really remote access at all, being not possible. That was a clear statement by Post Office to the public and to Parliament, and it was simply untrue. That's a big matter, and it appears that he took advice. It's not clear from whom. He took advice that this document ought not to be provided to the board. One wonders who took that decision and on what conceivable basis, because this is plainly a board matter. One's tempted to reflect as to if this document wasn't provided to the board, what other documents weren't provided to the board? I mean, we plainly know that the board did refer the Jenkins issues to its insurers. One seems to me to be a wrong characterisation.
What do you think might happen as a result of this Swift review becoming public? What kind of consequences do you think it might have?
Well, the consequences depend upon what the answers to the questions that arise out of it are. And amongst those questions, I think most simply are the questions of what was done in response to the recommendations, important recommendations in various respects of the. Of Mr. Swift, the three most important being the ones we've touched upon, what was done, and if nothing was done, why not? And if they were acted upon, and as it were, the Post Office had answers to the question of leveraging guilty pleas by theft charges, if they had answers to the issue of remote access, and if they had answers to the question of unattributed funds in suspense accounts. Well, what happened to that information and who did it go to? Because it was of vital importance. The other thing that is really, really important about this is what was not provided to Mr. Swift and what information was not provided to him at the time of providing this report. And high up in those in the list of those issues is what was he informed that the Post Office in 2013 notified its insurers about concerns about Mr. Jenkins's evidence? Were they provided with the July 2013 clerk advice? Were they provided with the Ismay report of 2010? Were they provided with the Detica report, which concluded that post office systems weren't fit for purpose in a modern retail environment? Incidentally, on that, there's another important point which hit me quite strongly when I was reading this, is that there's a review, there's a section which deals with the post office ATM machines, which were provided by Bank of Ireland, I think. And one of the important findings in the Detica report, and this is a point which is Detica is great importance. This is one of the points which is not picked up and ought to be picked up and has a bearing on some of the Court of Appeal decisions where they say that, well, these prosecutions weren't Horizon prosecutions, I mean, Horizon wasn't fundamental to them. What Detica say in a section of their report, and this is obviously from recollection, is that there were errors endemic in reconciling accounts from ATM machines, in balancing ATM machine accounts, probably a better way of putting it. And they say in terms, these problems, these balancing errors are impossible to attribute simply to fraud on the part of the postmasters concerned. Now, that's terribly important because that ties in with Dettiker's other conclusion, which is that the post office's systems generally, it's not just concerned with Horizon, it's concerned with the post office's systems. Dettiker's concluded that the post office's systems were not fit for purpose in a modern retail environment. Well, that's of overwhelming importance, and it must, I mean, that must have been considered at board level. If it was considered at board level, this is October 2013. There's no reference to it that I've been able to identify in Mr. Swift's report. And the question is, why not? And if it was not provided to him, after all, this is a review by Dettiker that would have cost the post office hundreds of thousands of pounds, if not millions. Why was it not provided to him? And if it was provided, why is it not mentioned? And as I say, that needs to be looked at in context with the post office's report to its own insurers in 2013 that it was cognizant of a reportable risk in connection with evidence given by Mr. Jenkins in its prosecutions. The point about that is it's recognised that this is a commercial risk to the post office. And a report of that kind wouldn't be made lightly. Which is, in a sense, a statement of the obvious. So I mean, that's a lengthy way of answering your question. But the question is, what's the impact of this going to be, Rebecca? I think the answer is it will have a substantial impact, and it now raises a whole lot of very challenging questions for a number of very senior employees of the post office. And no doubt some of the biggest questions will be questions for the post office's general counsel, because the legal strategy that was adopted in subsequent to this report is difficult to interpret. You've used the expression, Nick, cover up, but it's the response to this is very difficult to interpret. One would have thought that if properly handled, this report might have clarified and resolved issues that remained and became issues in the litigation much sooner. So on the face of it, one gets the impression that, to use the expression, this was buried, might be overstating it, but one is bound to wonder what was done with it, and one is bound to question very seriously how a report of this kind wasn't reviewed and considered at board level with the whole of the post office board. It plainly was not, and the fact that it wasn't, I think, raises grave questions. And obviously Tim Parker, his judgment is really in quite serious question as a result of this and the fact that he didn't take it to the board. And of course he was chairman of the post office at the time, as you say, Nick, of the attempt to remove Mr. Justice Fraser at the time of the in the course of the Horizon Issues trial, following the Common Issues trial. That raises questions as well, given what Mr. Parker knew about this document.
Okay, brilliant. So we've talked quite a lot about the Swift report, and it kind of it feeds into a lot of what we talked about with relation to the Sunday Times piece that Sabar Meddings wrote for the Sunday papers just gone. So it would have been the 7th of August that her piece came out, looking at perversion of the course of justice and whether or not we should be looking at people going to prison or at least facing trial for the roles that they played in the whole case. A lot of this was based on a letter that you wrote to the Director of Public Prosecutions, Would you be able to tell me a bit about that letter and why you wrote it to him?
Well, I suppose my motivation in writing it was really twofold. I suppose it's fair to say that I probably know as much or more about this saga than perhaps most, having been, as it were, on the shop floor for a good deal of time. And I was for some years very seriously unwell, and I had time on my hands, so I was able to devote time to this in a way that anyone in normal practice wouldn't be able to have devoted to it. But I suppose my motivation was one is consciousness of the devastation, and I use the word advisedly, the devastation that the post office's actions has wreaked on the personal lives of those who were subject to its prosecutions and other legal processes over an enormously long time, and consciousness of the really the blighted lives that many people now have had as a result of the post office's conduct. And on the other, I think increasing recognition that when Mr. Justice Fraser wrote to the Director of Public Prosecutions in January of 2020, referring Mr. Jenkins and Chambers to the DPP for his consideration as to whether they were both Fujitsu technical people, and Chambers gave evidence at Mr. Castleton's trial in 2006, and Mr. Jenkins famously gave live oral evidence for the first time in Mrs. Misra's trial in October of 2010. They both, in Mr. Justice Fraser's view, despite them unusually not appearing as witnesses before him, he concluded that they didn't give a full account of their knowledge and therefore complete evidence to the court as they were bound by their oath to do. But it struck me that he really did, if I might say so, he didn't know the half of it, really, because there were numbers of other documents that struck me as being documents which, in effect, had been withheld from the litigants in the civil litigation, and information, importantly, that had been withheld from convicted defendants post their convictions up to about 2013. And really, the thing that concerns me really is that perverting the course of justice, just to make it clear, is, I mean, the course of justice is really the ability and the act of judges adjudicating on rights and liabilities and adjusting rights and liabilities between individuals, and that includes and extends to both the criminal and civil jurisdictions. And perverting the course of justice is really, in a nutshell, so people understand, is acts which are undertaken which are intended to have the effect of interfering with the administration of justice, i.e. the ability of the court to do what it's there to do. And the key is that it's an act done with that intention. It doesn't need to have that effect, or it doesn't need to be successful. It just needs to have that purpose. And really, anything that is done which obstructs the capacity of the court to do justice will fall within that, if undertaken with that intention. And that extends to and includes acts which are calculated to exclude a person from access to the courts. And by that, really, I'm referring to the extraordinary circumstance that, in a sense, this encapsulates it. You have in 2013 an enormous review undertaken by Cartwright King, ostensibly for the purpose of looking at the convictions that the Post Office has secured by its prosecutions. Hundreds of cases were reviewed on a rather, in my view, skewed basis, namely a limited question as to whether two documents should be disclosed to them. Nothing comes of that. And yet in 2019, the first tranche of, well, firstly you have the Horizon Issues judgment, and then in 2020 you have the CCRC referring the first tranche of appeals to the Court of Appeal. And of the 42 that are referred, 39 are successful. So one's bound to ask the question, well, what was the Post Office doing in 2013 in reviewing hundreds of its prosecutions, which led to not a single successful appeal, when in 2019 all the appeals, bar three, referred by the CCRC are, without exception, quashed on both grounds, both Category 1 abuse of process and Category 2 abuse of process, the first being disclosure failures. And what is clear is that in 2013, the very extensive review undertaken by Cartwright King was a review of the requirement to disclose further documents to convicted defendants. Well, as I say, nothing resulted from that. Well, that's an extraordinary difference, isn't it? It only needs to be stated for it to be clear that it was that there's an extraordinary mismatch between the outcome in 2021 of the appeals and what the Post Office was doing in 2013. And why was the Post Office doing it in 2013? Well, it was doing it because the Post Office knew, because it had the Clark advice, that in many cases, evidence given in its prosecutions was incomplete and unreliable. But it seems to me that the scope and nature of the review undertaken in 2013 wasn't really addressed to the real issue. The real issue was not whether particular documents should be disclosed to defendants, but whether, given what the Post Office knew about bugs and errors in its system, that information ought to be disclosed to convicted postmasters. And for that, you track back to the receipts and payments mismatch bug in 2010. And, you know, we've touched on it already, but it's recognised in that in that high-level discussion between Fujitsu and the Post Office in 2010 that there was a bug which would cause a postmaster's accounts to appear to balance, but would in fact show an error or a shortfall at Fujitsu's mainframe accounting system in Bracknell. Well, that goes to the heart of what postmasters were complaining about. They were saying that they had accounts which failed to balance and they couldn't explain.
There's also the fact that we've talked about this already as well, that people were kind of pressured into pleading guilty, which could also be seen as perversion of the course of justice.
The question there is actually a rather narrower one. It's why they did so, and what undoubtedly is improper, to my mind, is interfering with the course of justice, is in various cases, it's documented that the Post Office elicited pleas to guilty for false accounting on the basis of dropping a theft charge, but on condition extracted from the hapless postmaster that they make no criticism of the Horizon system. Now, that seems to me to have been a wholly improper thing to do. Anything which is done with the intention of changing somebody's evidence on the basis of an inducement or favour or indulgence or benefit is arguably improper. But the thing perhaps that exercises me most is that documents which would have been of fundamental importance, or information if you want, that would have been of fundamental importance, both in the civil litigation, but also to convicted defendants, was on the face of it withheld. And indeed, not only that, but the Post Office gave a palpably false explanation to Mr. Justice Fraser in 2019 as the reason for Mr. Jenkins not appearing as a witness in those proceedings, because a lot of the evidence, technical evidence given for the Post Office in the Horizon Issues trial, was emanated from Mr. Jenkins without being attributed to him. Now, the reason that he wasn't called was explained by the Post Office. They said that the reason that it's explained by Mr. Justice Fraser in his judgment recites this under a heading, I think, which is the non-appearance of Mr. Jenkins as a witness. The Post Office explained that the reason for his non-appearance was that it was thought that his involvement in the prosecution of Mrs. Mizrin, him giving evidence at her trial, might be a distraction. Well, of course, that wasn't the true reason. The true reason was that in 2013, the Post Office had received advice from Mr. Simon Clark that Mr. Jenkins shouldn't be called in any other proceedings as a witness, as a technical witness for the Post Office, because his credibility, I think from recollection, had quotes been wholly undermined. And he would put the Post Office in breach of its obligations to the court. Now, that was the true reason. Now, that's very important, because what it means is that the Post Office was, in fact, giving evidence in the Horizon Issues trial indirectly from Mr. Jenkins, knowing that he was a witness that they couldn't tender for cross-examination for the reasons that Mr. Clark had given. Well, that seems to me to be pretty improper. And the second thing is that the explanation given to Mr. Justice Fraser, the reason for him not appearing, was simply false. The reason he couldn't be called was that he was known to be a unreliable witness to the truth.
There's a lot of issues around disclosure, and you talk a lot about them in your letter. Just going back to this Swift review that we've been talking about, Jonathan Swift says that... I think it was 2015 he's writing. 2016. So he says that broadly the Post Office is okay in its approach to disclosure, that it hasn't acted improperly around that. We've already covered this, but do you understand how he got there at all?
No, it's completely incomprehensible. I can't see any conceivable basis for him having arrived at that conclusion. And in fact, the fact that it's a wrong and false conclusion is put beyond question by the 39 successful appeals in April 2021, where in every case the appeal is quashed in the first instance on the basis that the Post Office failed to give proper disclosure of data to defendants that it was prosecuting. And really, I've lighted on this a bit earlier, but it exhibits a complete inability to understand the nature of, if you like, computer disclosure. Mr. Justice Fraser really puts this. I should say. I think this is a systemic problem. I think it's a massive problem, and it's a massive problem for the criminal justice system. It's probably a massive problem for courts more generally. Because when you go back to Mr. Castleton's civil claim in 2006, he was. He was defendant to a civil claim for about £26,000. In that case, virtually every material finding by the judge in connection with the reliability of Horizon data is now shown to have been wrong. And the reason he was wrong is because Mr. Castleton simply didn't have disclosure of the relevant records to him. That's one aspect of it. The other aspect of it is that Anne Chambers plainly knew of problems in his case, and she gave evidence which the trial judge found to be compelling, but Mr. Justice Fraser found that as a fact that she formed the view that she hadn't disclosed her knowledge of bugs in Horizon and their effects at his trial. But I mean, that's a bit of a sidestep. But Mr. Justice Fraser, in his Horizon issues judgment, puts the point very simply. He said he dismisses, if in effect, the post office's technical evidence. And the post office's technical evidence, given by a chap called Dr. Worden, who was the post office expert, was effectively to this extent, to this effect. The post office has thousands of branches. It has tens of thousands of Horizon branched terminals. It processes millions of transactions every day. Of all those transactions, almost all of them seem to be satisfactory, with a few problems with a limited number of postmasters. And what Mr. Justice Fraser says is that this evidence really boiled down to the proposition that Horizon operated perfectly well most of the time. But he's virtually contemptuous of that, rightly, as a proposition, because, as he says, the real question is this: in what circumstances is Horizon and was Horizon known to fail? Once you have got the answer to that question, which is answered very simply by records of bugs and their effects, and we know that those records were kept and maintained by Fujitsu on a daily basis for the whole of the life of the Horizon. Once you know what those bugs are and what their known effects are, then you do a very simple exercise, which is to do a correlation between the known effects of bugs when they were present and the kind of complaints that are being made by postmasters in connection with the operation of their Horizon branch accounts. And if you apply one to the other, you will, in many cases, get the answer to whether the kind of bugs that exist and known to exist and their known effects have a propensity to cause the kind of problems of which postmasters complain. And really, the long and the short of the Horizon judgment, which is very lengthy, runs, I think, to more than 1,500 paragraphs. The long and the short of it is that Mr. Justice Fraser found that the kind of bugs that were present in the system and known to be present in the system were of a kind that did have the propensity to cause the kind of problems of which postmasters complained. None of that was disclosed. None of that was disclosed. And so when Mr. Swift says that he's content that the post office's approach to its disclosure, let me just remember it. It's paragraph 98. We're accordingly content that Post Office Limited had acted reasonably in its handling of disclosure issues arising in relation to past criminal prosecutions. That strikes me as having to quote an expression used by Mr. Justice Fraser himself. That exhibits, in my view, the most dreadful complacency. There's no possible basis that I'm able to identify in the review or report for that conclusion. And one wonders how Mr. Swift can possibly have arrived at it. And as I say, it's contradicted in fairly concrete terms by the Court of Appeal judgment in 2021. But it's a terribly important thing, because if you go back to Mrs. Misra's case, on four occasions she asked for disclosure, more disclosure of Horizon records. And her defence counsel very commendably said she cannot have a fair trial without further disclosure. And every single one of those four applications was dismissed by three different judges. And on the last occasion, when it was protested that she couldn't have a fair trial without the disclosure sought, the trial judge said, there's been a lot of technical disclosure in this case. I'm entirely satisfied that the trial is fair. Now, it took another 11 years for Mrs. Misra to have her conviction quashed. On what basis? On the first basis that she didn't have proper disclosure of Horizon records. So this shows really very convincingly, in my view, that neither lawyers nor judges commonly understand the nature of Horizon of computer disclosure and the propensity of computers to fail, and it's a subject on which I've written submissions both to the Ministry of Justice at the invitation of Alex Chalk MP, and also more recently for the assistance of Mr. Kevin Jones. And the recommendations that I, together with others, have made, including, I think, seven professors of computer science or information technology and others, are publicly available. Maybe you ought to attach them to your podcast, because I think they're important, and they represent the distillation of an enormous amount of both legal and technical expertise. And it seems the root of this problem is, of course, historic, and we don't have time for it now, but go back to Law Commission recommendations at the turn of the century. But the basic premise, and it's present in Mrs. Misra's trial, that a computer problem is and ought to be apparent to a computer operator is just nonsense. And the Law Commission advocated that as its view in, I think, 1997 or thereabouts, and it's just wholly wrong. And it's most unfortunate because the consequences of that misapprehension are there to see. And what is apparent is that applied without scrutiny and proper thought, it can have the consequence of blighting lives, as it has done.
I've just got some breaking news here, and I'm sorry to take you back to the Jonathan Swift review. Another Freedom of Information request response has shown a letter from the Permanent Secretary at the Business Department to Tim Parker, and it confirms that the decision by Tim Parker not to show the board the Swift report did come on advice from the Post Office's General Counsel. And this letter says, "We understand that you were advised at the time by Post Office's General Counsel that for reasons of confidentiality and preserving legal privilege, the circulation of the report should be strictly controlled. Nevertheless, given the background of parliamentary interest, the fact that your review was commissioned by the minister responsible for the Post Office and the potential significance of the recommendations made by Jonathan Swift, we consider it was a mistake not to have ensured that the whole board had an opportunity to see and discuss the detail of its findings and agree what any next steps should be. With hindsight, this information should have been seen by the board, and we are disappointed that it wasn't." I think that's quite a significant paragraph, and it chimes with what you were saying, Paul, about Mr. Parker's judgment.
Well, it's a statement of the blindingly obvious that this ought to have gone before the board, and it's extraordinary and demands explanation as to why it didn't go before the board. But of course, there's the other limb to this, of course, that this report will have gone to government as well. It's after all, Baroness Neville Rolfe who commissioned Mr. Parker to undertake this review, and it's inconceivable that this report didn't or review wasn't provided to BIS, BIS, given that it's a review that was undertaken pursuant to the direction of BIS, as in effect, indirectly through government investments, as the sole shareholder in the Post Office. And so the question is, what happened to this report, assuming it did go to the government, what happened to the report when it did come back to the government? Presumably, There will be those in government, in BIS, certainly the Permanent Civil Service, who will have read this report and its recommendations. So when this was heading towards litigation, presumably there would have been some people asking questions as to, well, what were the conclusions in the light of the recommendations made by Mr. Swift?
And how far up the chain it went when it went back to government, because you would assume that Neville Rolfe would be wondering what had happened to it. And you know Baroness Neville Rolfe, or you've had dealings with her before, haven't you, Rebecca?
Yes, yeah. I sort of know her a little bit through working at Retail Week.
Well, maybe we should get her on the podcast next what she knew about it.
I suspect this is very likely to grow, because one's starting to see here perhaps the beginnings of what emerged in the Matrix Churchill case, and you'll remember the Scott report there, where civil servants involved in handling the processing of export licenses became neutrally caught up in it might be said manipulating the truth, and there are very important questions to be asked here about who knew what when, because one of the encouraging things in a sense is that in 2015, I mean, this is very shortly after Jo Swinson had made her, well, it's less than a year after Jo Swinson had made her statement to Parliament about how important the government considered it was to get to the bottom of things. So the mandate, the September mandate from Baroness Neville Rolfe to Tim Parker is quite close in timeline to both Jo Swinson's statement and the German debate in December 2014. It's also, of course, very close to the sacking of Second Sight. So those issues were quite still quite warm at that stage. And so there's a question as to what government knew about these things, in particular between February 2016 and when the litigation kicks off in 2019.
you do wonder when the only reference or reason or suggestion that the review has been requested is prompted by the Panorama, whether the minister saw the Panorama and just said, well, hang on a minute, what's going on here, let's get to the bottom of it, whether she was properly briefed about what had gone on before, because very often ministers
That is kind of how the letter reads.
Yeah, but again, it might be convenient just to point to something that's already in the public domain rather than something that is
a
hitherto made decision.
Could I quickly ask Paul, very quickly, do you think that this adds pressure to the DPP to look into this question of perversion of the course of justice?
Well, I don't think the DPP, apart from its limited resources, is going to be pressured by this. But it raises further questions. I have to say, one's bound to have quite substantial questions about the Cartwright King review in 2013 to 2014, in particular, given that the scope and scale of that review is said by Mr. Swift to have been subject of oversight and advice from Mr. Altman QC. The other thing that I find extraordinary about this review is that repeatedly, I think it's fair to say repeatedly, Mr. Swift touches on the possibility of further advice being obtained, and Mr. Altman QC appears in on numbers of occasions throughout the review. One of the things that occurs to me is, given the nature of the issues, wouldn't a sensible course have been to enlist the assistance not of a prominent prosecuting counsel, but of a criminal barrister experienced in defence work. Because in many instances, the questions that arise are, well, what would the impact of this have been on the defence if the information had been available? And it's not only that, it's not only on the information that the defence is actually ex post facto. Once you get past 2014, what would be the effect of, for instance, the material in the Clark advice being revealed? And importantly on that, when the Clark advice is disclosed in 2020, the Post Office explained that it's being disclosed on the basis of the disclosure obligation on a prosecutor identified by the Supreme Court in a case called the Chief Constable of Suffolk. And they say that it's disclosed on that basis. Well, that being the case, one has to ask why it wasn't disclosed from 2013, given that the material was available to the Post Office as prosecutor at that time. No explanation is available for that at all. And it seems to me that the information about the unreliability of Mr. Jenkins was information that was bound to be disclosed to the Post Office had prosecuted, where Mr. Jenkins had given evidence. And in particular, obviously, given that she was formerly a client of mine, Mrs. Miserab was prosecuted at the only trial where Mr. Jenkins gave live oral evidence. And the Post Office had concluded in 2013, 3 years later, that in every case reviewed, those are subsequent cases, he'd given unreliable evidence. Well, I would have thought any barrister or any lawyer acting for Mrs. Misery would have been deeply interested in that. But there we are.
Yeah, and it's still interesting that a document like this, Swift Review, can be released under FOI, but the Post Office are hanging grimly on to the Altman Review of 2013 and any summary as to the results of what happened in the Cartwright King review. They've refused to give those to me. We better wrap up. We're going to wrap up, Rebecca. Are you? Everyone must be exhausted by now.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you so much, Paul.
It's an absolute pleasure.
Yeah. Thanks very much, Paul. We're very grateful. We will try and get Baroness Neville Rolfe on, given Rebecca's personal contacts with her, to see if she wants to.
I wouldn't call them personal contacts. Okay, but yeah, we're going to ask her.
Richard Roll to give you an interview. I think he was one of the most interesting people in the story.
Really. Well, he's become so significant in retrospect when you realise the sort of chain of events that led to him coming forward and then giving the interview and then being that witness in court. And how everything or a lot of things turned on what he had to say. No, I agree. We're building quite a list, but we're very, very grateful to you for coming on today.
Yeah, we are. Thank you.
Absolute pleasure. Cheerio.
The barrister, Paul Marshall, our thanks to him for his time.
If you want to read the full Jonathan Swift's Chairman's Review, it's up on postofficescandal.uk.
Thank you very much for listening to Investigating the Post Office Scandal. This podcast is produced, presented, edited and owned by Rebecca Thompson and Nick Wallace.
With production support and wisdom from Whistledown Productions.
Thank you and goodbye.
See you next time.